Mr. Schreier.
May it please the court, counsel. Although we have a fairly complicated factual record before the court, I think the thrust of the appeal and the point I wish...
Speaking of the complications, I didn't understand. What is it that do you think the banks did that was bad? Right, the banks, as I understand it, they're directed to purchase these CDs, and they do so, and then they're told to sell them and give the proceeds to these individuals. But so far as it appears, the banks... I mean, it's perfectly proper for a bank to honor a request by a corporation to make a payment to an individual. What's the...
Well, the claims are under the Illinois Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. And under the definition of transfer, the bank was a transferee of monies we believe were fraudulently transferred to them to hinder us as a creditor.
Sure, but that doesn't matter. I mean, if the bank receives money without having any reason to think there's any impropriety, and then it pays it out on directions of the depositor without any reason to think there's any impropriety, then it's not liable as for a fraudulent transfer.
Well, as Your Honor knows, there are two requirements. They have to take in good faith, and they have to give adequate consideration in return.
Adequate consideration is not the issue here. It's just good faith.
No, Your Honor. I believe adequate consideration is as well. We cite the Scholes.
The banks are given money, and then they pay it out again. What's the consideration?
They were given money from the escrow account. The escrow account, in essence, is owned by the people who are buying and selling real estate. It's held in trust by Old Intercounty. Old Intercounty took escrow monies, bought CDs with other people's money. Whether the banks knew it was other people's money is a question of fact. And whether or not they
that's the issue of bad faith. But you seem to think that if the banks, even if the banks were acting in good faith, they would have to cough up the money, even though they were just moving money back and forth in response to the depositor's orders.
Under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, they also have to give adequate consideration. The consideration
what does that mean?
They
a
gave
bank doesn't give consideration. A bank receives money, stores it, invests and so on, and then when the depositor wants it back or wants it sent somewhere else, the bank honors that direction.
Your Honor, the consideration that was given to Old Intercounty. It was not given to the escrow beneficiaries, who are, in essence, the transferors.
But that does get back to the good faith issue. If the bank has no idea that the money coming from Company A is anything but dollars, then to say, well, the bank didn't give adequate consideration because those dollars really belonged to X, not Company A, means that you have an extraordinary standard of kind of strict liability here for banks. If the bank did know, that's different, but that's a good faith issue.
Okay. With all respect to the court, of course, this is not the basis in which the district court issued its opinion. It was solely on statute of limitations. And secondly, I don't believe it's a particularly...
Why did you not sue on the statute of limitations as soon as in January you realized what had gone on? I can't figure out why you waited for another... 11 months or so.
Well, it is true that with respect to three of the banks, we found out what went on January 26, 2001. And we did sue within 1 year as permitted by the statute.
Well,
why we waited 363 days I can speculate as the answer, but I can't tell you definitively.
But my problem with your theory... Here.
No, my firm was not involved. I was involved in other litigation, but not in this particular litigation.
I had the same question as my colleague. It's quite extraordinary. You have two possible dates from which the limitations period might run, 2 weeks, 2 months apart. And your client then carefully waits 13 months from the first date and 11 months from the second date to file a lawsuit.
I could offer
it's
some
quite unbelievable.
I could offer some speculation, but and take it at that if the court would. Fidelity is a financial institution. It deals heavily with other financial institutions, banks and the like. to take the decision to sue 8 major banks is not one that is lightly made. And it was not an easy decision. Because I know something about the company. I think that is the primary
reason.
And
so your client opted for the worst of all possible worlds. You would choose to insult the banks in a way that made it impossible for your client to recover any money.
Is that a rhetorical question?
I think it may be. Let me back up on a sort of more conceptual point about Section 10 of the Illinois Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. You are relying on this last option could reasonably have been discovered by the claimant. But I'm going to suggest that there is a date at which something could reasonably have been discovered, which is a date before it has been discovered, because the statute also contemplates within 1 year after the transfer was discovered. That's one date, could reasonably have been discovered. Now, in these sort of extension periods of statutes of limitations, it's not really a year. It's not, you know, now you have a year to sit around and meditate before you sue. It's going to be something less than a year. There's a date by which you reasonably could have been discovered. The investigation takes place, and then a year minus X is the time left over for you. And because it's an extension, it's not the original 4 years that the statute gives you, which you could observe the transfer and sit around and go on vacation for 4 years and then sue. But this is a different kind of provision, and your assumption seems to be that the could reasonably have been discovered period doesn't start running that 1 year until you actually do discover.
Right, and the focus, again,
I don't think that's right at all. That reads out of the statute the fact that it also gives you a year after the transfer was discovered.
And again, the focus is on the transfer, not
on but the transfer could reasonably have been discovered. It means you haven't discovered it yet. There's a set of cases, let's say, where it hasn't been discovered yet, and you still have only a year from that date.
Right. And I believe the court is somewhat touching on the difference between a statute of limitations and a statute of repose.
Well, I'm just looking at Section 10 and seeing that it gives you 4 years from the transfer, if you happen to know about that, but then, or if later, within 1 year, and then there are two options that trigger the 1 year, after it was actually discovered, or, your instance, after it could reasonably have been discovered.
Correct.
And I don't think you're necessarily going to know about the transfer during the beginning of that period of time that's covered by the last section. And I'm not even getting into Gilbert and all the rest of it, but just looking at the statute, it seems to me there has to be a period of time when you are in the process of discovering it, even though you haven't discovered it yet.
But again, I submit that no one has argued that Fidelity hadn't acted with great diligence.
No, but
once
But that's why you had a whole year. You were alerted to it. In other words, you reasonably could have discovered it. Certainly Fidelity does seem to have gotten right on the ball after that comment about office scuttlebutt and so forth. They discover pretty quickly. There's quite a bit of time left still to run in that year. And for whatever reason, Fidelity doesn't file.
But I submit, Your Honor, that we did file within the 1 year permitted by the statute.
No, you filed within 1 year of actual discovery.
I would also submit that we filed within when we reasonably could have discovered it. And again, it is the specific transfer to the specific bank. A lot of the imprecision that Judge Hibbler employed, I think, was because he was dealing with 8 different cases with 8 different sets of facts.
I don't think Judge Hibbler was so imprecise.
Well, Your Honor, I've read Judge Hibbler's opinion a number of times.
So
and
have
between
I.
pages 23 and 30 of his opinion, Appendix 24 through 31, he formulates the rule a slightly different way 3 or 4 different times. He even goes so far as to say on page 30 that in order for the statute to begin, Fidelity didn't even need to know which banks were involved in this scheme because the particular defendant need not be known. That may be a principle under general Illinois tort law. It is not a provision that the drafters of the Fraudulent Transfer Act put into their act. I believe Judge Hibbler was wrong in saying that all that needed to be known.
I don't understand. Why do you say that?
Judge Hibber followed
because
Gilbert Brothers.
Because if you look at 10, the reasonable discovery of the fraudulent transfer could precede knowledge of the particular transferees, right?
No, Your Honor. I believe the transfer means a specific transfer. A specific transfer requires knowledge of a transferor and a transferee in virtually all cases.
You don't get that out of the statute. So if it's a general principle of Illinois statute of limitations law that you don't necessarily have to know the identity of all the defendants, why wouldn't that apply equally to Section 10?
Because while it's a general principle of Illinois tort law, it would not apply to the specific statute expressly written into the Fraudulent Transfer Act.
Why is this different from a standard discovery?
This has its own discovery rule written in it.
Pardon?
The Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act has a specific statute of limitations written into it.
But there's nothing about this discovery rule, is there, that differentiates it from the common law graft onto statute of limitations that don't mention discovery?
I submit there is, Your Honor. This isn't the sponge left in the plane in the body on the operating table. It isn't a leaking roof at a college facility.
Why do those facts matter? I mean, you've made the point repeatedly in your brief that for this purpose the injury is the transfer, but I don't see why, first of all, there could be a period of time between the transfer and when it's discovered, when it reasonably could have been discovered, and I don't understand why you need to know who the money went to if you know the money seeped out of the entity that was making the fraudulent transfer.
The Illinois tort statute speaks of knowledge of an injury, a generalized injury, and it being wrongfully caused.
But I've already taken that into account in my question. I'm saying here the injury is the transfer. So we substitute the word transfer for the word injury, but we still have a period of time when it hasn't yet been discovered, but it reasonably could have been.
The fraudulent transfers are aimed at one type of defendant alone, and that is a transferee. The normal tort law.
What if you have successive transferees, which must be extremely common? So you learn that your debtor has transferred money to his wife. Well, but so you've discovered the injury. Don't you have an obligation at that point to find out whether the money has remained with the wife, or maybe it's been transferred to children or parents or someone else? Because that would be something you'd quite expect. They try to keep moving the money away. So wouldn't you have to investigate that?
In honesty, I can think of situations where the situation was such that knowledge of one transfer having occurred would lead me to believe that I should follow that money further. If it went to a Swiss bank or an off-sea island, I can believe that it might then go to some other.
If it goes to a bank at all, I mean, banks obviously are constantly transferring money out, so.
I can think of situations, and I'm agreeing with the court here, where it may be that knowledge of one transfer should lead me to follow that same money to a subsequent transferee. That is not the case here, however. And I would also like to point out to the
court.
Why
not?
Because all we had in December was generalized office scuttlebutt that there may have been pledges of money. Not that the money, incidentally, had eventually been foreclosed on or the CD had been liquidated, only that escrow money may have been used for CDs. No banks were identified, no sums were identified, no dates were identified.
But this is very much like the Salisbury case, because the Illinois court there reproduces the discovery deposition of Robert, and he's asked in the midst of this, was there a transfer of title at some point? Answer, yes. When was the transfer of title? And he says, oh, geez, I can't remember. Let me see, approximately the time of the incident. It sounds exactly like the sort of vague office scuttlebutt that you're talking about here. You guys didn't behave as though this was nothing. As though it was very important.
Your Honor, in Salisbury, there was one party involved, the Salisburys. They knew exactly who they were going for. We had dozens and dozens and dozens of financial institutions that were involved with New Intercounty and Old Intercounty.
But that doesn't necessarily, that doesn't go to the question of the moment when you reasonably could have found out. It just means that maybe if you had had a very difficult time tracking it down and it had taken you 13 months instead of two, you know, would there be some argument for equitable tolling or estoppel of the one-year period? I don't know, because that's certainly not this case. But there's a moment at which you reasonably could have found out, and then there's the period of time that your reasonable investigation consumes.
And I would submit the moment we could have reasonably found out for three of the banks was January 26th, and for the remainder of the banks beginning the end of February. Because that, in fact, is when our very diligent investigation and help from the IRS, incidentally, which came out of the blue, gave us knowledge of the transfers and started the statute of limitations running. And rather than knowledge of the transfers, what Judge Hibbler looked at was a generic possibility that there may have been something called fraudulent transfers that could have occurred. Not the transfer, but rather a generalized type of...
Well, so what you're really saying that what the statute means is it's transfer to rather than transfer from, right? That's what you're saying. So even if you know that the money has been transferred away from your debtor, nevertheless, that's not reasonable discovery of the transfer.
Well, no, we knew that the escrow account had been looted.
That's your argument, right?
My argument is that knowledge that the escrow account had generally been looted.
Let me see if you understand.
That is my argument.
It is your argument.
It is my argument.
It's transfer to, not transfer from, that triggers the statute.
We need to know the recipient, yes. Transfer to.
And what's your basis for that?
The essence of what the Fraudulent Transfer Act is about, namely to find the transferee.
The essence of it is it's the debtor transferring money, you know, to defeat the creditor. Who he transfers it to is a detail, I would think. You know,
we need to know the name.
Hides it somewhere.
We need to know the name of the defendant to sue, and that would be the transferee of the funds.
That's usually what the year is for. Your presentation. This is related to the point Judge Wood made. Your presentation treats the statute of limitations as a period for rest and recuperation after you already have enough in hand to sue. But the reason why the statute of limitations is a year rather than a month is to allow some investigation. Is there any reason why, with what you knew in January about the transfer from out of intercounty, a reasonable investigation would not have turned up this information in short order? Well, it did turn it up in short order.
It did turn it up in short order once
Which
we knew on
to
January
the question,
26th.
Why the difference between transfer to and transfer from matters, given how easy it was to find who the recipients were.
I can only submit, Your Honor, that the transfer to is what the Act is about and what it requires. Whether we waited a year or whether we waited a month after we found out, I have apologies to make that we waited a year, but we still were within
the
legal period.
Thing, you don't talk about tolling, right? So there is a tolling, an equitable tolling defense. So if, in fact, you discovered the transfer had been made, but it actually took you more than a year to find out who the transferees were in order to be able to sue them, then the way we take care of it would be through tolling. You diligently endeavor to sue within the statutory period, but you couldn't, and then you get an extension. Tolling would be a superfluous doctrine if discovery was interpreted as loosely as you're suggesting. Right, you'd never need tolling if discovery doesn't occur until you have every single fact that you need to draft your complaint.
I don't submit that we needed every single fact, Your Honor. I submitted
what
that is when
need?
We reasonably could have discovered the transfer obligation, reasonably could have discovered. And I submit that that date for us was January 26, 2001. May I reserve the rest of my time?
Sure. Hey, thank you, Mr. Shire. Ms. Lischer?
Good morning, Your Honors. Council. My name is Nancy Lisher, and I'm here to present only the arguments in the joint brief on the statute of limitations. There are a couple of...
Actually, before you start, I have an extraneous question. Do you know the status of the criminal prosecutions?
I do not. I do not. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I could provide that.
Okay. Thank you.
What's notably absent in plaintiff's argument is the fact that there are not one but two appellate court decisions which directly address the statute of limitations and UFTA, or the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. Both of these cases, as Judge has pointed out, are factually similar, and both hold that under Illinois law, whether it is under a statutory common law rule or if it's under a common law discovery rule, that Salisbury and Gilbert follow Illinois Supreme Court precedent. The plaintiff argues that under the express statutory language, that you must give effect to the word transfer, or so their argument goes in their brief. But the corollary rule is that it's presumed that the legislature knew of judicial construction given to certain types of language. And this statute also uses classic discovery rule language, as plaintiff admits in the reply on page 5. And therefore, under Knox College, Nolan, and Witherell, all three Illinois appellate court cases, and all three were decided before UFTA was adopted in 1990, you must assume that the legislature understood and intended to apply that judicial construction of the discovery rule.
I don't understand the role of presumptions in your argument. This is a uniform statute. All right. One doesn't go around presuming things based on Illinois law about uniform statutes. And there are, of course, comments that the uniform state law commissioners append to these sections. So are you relying on the drafting history? It's all open and public and available.
Actually,
I didn't see any of it in your brief.
Well, the problem is that there is none, Your Honor. I looked for the legislative history. I asked for... they tape the committee's report. They have committees, meetings, and they tape them. I asked for that. They didn't have it. The only thing you have here is legislative intent as stated in the comments. I agree. These are comments that say that the statute was supposed to be to make this uniform. But if you look at the research in other states, you'll see that at least four other states, like Illinois, do apply common law discovery rule principles and have said common law applies to UFTA. And you'll also see...
Your opponents suggest that there are other states that don't see it that way, which doesn't make it sound terribly uniform.
Well, I don't think it is terribly uniform. It's unlike the case in Rodriguez, where the Fifth District had created this continuing tort rule that extended...
Neither of the Illinois cases tackles the question that's presented here. That is, whether the statutory reference refers to transfers from or transfers to. Neither of the state cases discusses that.
Correct. They do not go through the statutory construction.
Do any of the state Supreme Courts that have grappled with this discuss it? I looked up the citations in your brief, and they don't refer to state Supreme Courts that have discussed that question.
No, I know of no cases, Your Honor, that go through
the
statutory.
So it's a fresh question, and how should it be answered?
Well, Your Honor, it should be answered by looking to Gilbert
Salisbury. How should it be? What is the sensible solution? Don't be so case-bound.
The sensible solution to interpreting this statute? The sensible solution is to say that there are two dates here. One is when the transfer was actually made, and the second is when it reasonably could have been discovered. And then you have to look at what is the purpose behind any statute of limitations, which is to encourage diligence, not just in inquiry, but also to file suit. And they did nothing. They did the inquiry rapidly, and although they say it was a difficult investigation, The truth is, they admit that in their reply that within a month they had all the information. There are two dates provided in this statute.
How did they obtain the information in a month?
There were only three steps they took after Stimek's interview, and this is in Mr. Lipinskas, the attorney's deposition. He looked at the Deloitte & Touche database. That had all the information they needed to target the defendants. It had insider transactions and loans, CDs, and bank names. The plaintiff today says, oh, well, there were a lot of banks. But the truth is that within a month, according to their own scenario, they knew exactly who to sue and still chose not to within the one-year statute of limitations. The second thing they did, each interview, there were three of them, lasted about 2 hours. The first one was with the attorney. And there was a follow-up for another 4 hours with the accountant from Deloitte & Touche, Mr. Pollard. And Stimek handed to Pollard everything that he needed to know about the database, the way the finances worked, what documents to look at in order to identify what was going on. And the third step they took was to cause the subpoenas to be issued. The plaintiff argues that until they had answers to the subpoenas, the time doesn't start. And they said nobody reasonably could have discovered this information beforehand. But that ignores the fact that the IRS figured it out without answers to the subpoenas. In addition, Gilbert held, you have no right to wait for subpoena answers to flesh out all the details of your cause of action. This court has held, you do not need to identify all the defendants in the LeBlanc case, and you do not need to identify who all the potential defendants are, and those cases are in our brief.
But you're arguing that actually doesn't matter here because they had, in fact, identified all of the defendants
they had
who were before us by the time that, actually, I guess it's some three of them were a month and the others were a bit longer, but
correct.
Well within the year.
Correct. My argument is under Illinois law, and under the words of this statute, as interpreted by Illinois case law, and there's no indication the Supreme Court would hold otherwise, there is a point where a person has sufficient information, they're put on inquiry notice, or they're on notice that there's been a transfer or an injury that has been wrongfully caused. That's what the year is for, to both sue and investigate. And in here, all the complaints about how difficult it was, they admit it took a month. And the IRS did it without subpoena answers.
Well, the district court also should the district court have placed any weight on the fact that the IRS asked about CDs for the benefit of the individuals?
Your Honor, what the district court said was, in the sense, in Stimek's information was not just a rumor. Lipinskas admitted that as of that fall, he admitted that he knew that the insiders were essentially using those escrow accounts as a checkbook. And I believe what the district court said was this wasn't an unsubstantiated rumor, but it was corroborated by the fact that the IRS was investigating and the fact that Banco Popular had already been sued by the plaintiffs. You know, the December 8 memo, if you look at it in its entirety, the IRS is basically the precursor to all those questions to Stimek. IRS asks about escrow transfers, excessive escrow transfers to the operating accounts, reimbursements to the insiders, funds to insider companies like Capjack, CDs that have been bought with escrow funds, and
but, you know, that's the, almost
insider
the problem
loans.
With the IRS thing. It's a real cover the waterfront sort of memo, and you might think, okay, you know, it's just a fishing expedition. You know, no reason to draw any inference that any of those things actually happened.
Right. So they interview Stimek. They get additional information with Garfield Bank. They're expressly told that escrow funds are being, or that I believe it's company funds are being used, intercounty funds are being used to pay off Pelosi's an insider's mortgage. So they get with Stimek additional details. Plus, they had the data bank, Deloitte & Touche, and they were working hand in hand. They had the data bank by which they could target defendants.
But I guess the broader question here is looking at this statute of limitations, How strictly should one understand the phrase "could reasonably have been discovered"? Every stray bit of office gossip is probably not enough of a basis on which to rush off and file lawsuits against people, or for that matter, perhaps even start issuing subpoenas. People say a lot of things. So what's the threshold?
Well, where the facts are controverted, it's a fact issue, but here the facts aren't controverted. So the threshold would be, at what point, under a matter of law, are they on inquiry notice? Do they know both that the injury has been sustained and that it was wrongfully caused? At which point they have a twofold duty, investigate and sue within the year. And as this court has pointed out, this isn't a year of rest and recuperation. And the plaintiff said today, oh, well, it wasn't an easy issue to decide whether or not to sue. But I believe in their reply brief they said they managed to make that decision to include these allegations in the Stewart litigation by March. So I don't know why it was so difficult to understand when they should have been suing or whether they should sue. It seems to me enough money was at stake. It was a foregone conclusion to sue.
Could I ask you a different question? Why is so much in this record under seal? It seemed to me there was sort of a across-the-board practice of sealing things.
I know. I believe it's because they asserted the privilege, the work product privilege for Lipinski's DEP, and then at some point everything went under seal because they'd asserted this privilege, which, of course, the attorney Lipinski's testified pretty clearly. Yes, I contemplated litigation against those banks at the time he wrote the memo, which was more than a year earlier. And then he said, I'm sorry, Ed, because the attorney was trying to say privileged, but that question did get answered, and it stood for the record.
So you think it all should be unsealed at this point?
I don't have an opinion on that, Your Honor. I would be happy to get back to the court on it. The problem is, I was not a trial attorney. I don't know if there were additional factors. I don't think that the work product privilege merits at this point. Your Honors, if I may give the remaining time, if you have no further questions on statute of limitations, then I'll give my remaining minutes to Mr. Carroll, who will address the good faith and fair value.
Okay. Mr. Carroll, go ahead.
May it please the court, Martin Carroll on behalf of the First National Bank of LaGrange. Your Honors, obviously, if you affirm on the basis of the statute of limitations, you need not reach this alternative issue. LaGrange filed a supplemental brief in this case based on Section 9A of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, which provides that transfer is not voidable.
Why would we reach this anyway, given that the district court has yet to consider it?
It provides another basis for upholding the...
Yes, but why would the Court of Appeals reach this initially? I understand the document, the doctrine, that you can affirm on any ground preserved below, but usually we wait for the district court to reach these questions initially.
Well, your argument is there's no factual question, just a pure question of law.
That's correct,
that
Your Honor.
Argument?
That's correct. We believe that we are entitled to summary judgment.
They don't argue
below.
That there was any, you know, knowledge on the part of the banks.
No. And in fact, Fidelity has not contested the fact that LaGrange acted in good faith in this case. And in fact, LaGrange also provided a reasonably equivalent value. We have rather unique facts in this case. We provided uncontested evidence.
But you're arguing just for the one bank, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Did the other banks make that argument? Or
one other bank, Your Honor, Charter Bank.
Is that?
Actually, Charter Bank also made a similar argument, although we have slightly different facts.
But in this court, who makes? Is it just LaGrange and who else?
LaGrange and Charter Bank.
LaGrange and Charter, yeah.
Correct, Your Honor. LaGrange submitted uncontested evidence in the form of affidavits and documents that showed that Old Inter County received a pro rata reduction in its debt to its shareholders in connection with this loan transaction. And Fidelity's loan argument in response is that it says it doesn't matter what Old Inter County got. You have to look on what the Old Inter County escrowees received. There are two problems with this argument. Number one, there's nothing in the record that indicates that Fidelity is actually a creditor of the Old Inter-County escrowees, and in fact, in its own complaint, it alleges that it is a creditor of Old Inter County, not the escrowees. Secondly, they argued that the funds used to purchase CDs were escrow funds. But its own expert admitted in his deposition and in his report, and it's in their complaint, that the account from which the funds came from to purchase the CD in question also contained funds relating solely to Old Inter County. And we have a sworn affidavit from Old Inter County's attorney that stated the funds that were used were, in fact, funds that belonged to Old Inter County. And that affidavit is uncontested. There was no loss to the Old Inter County escrowees in this case. And the focus should properly be on Old Inter County because ultimately it was responsible
for
the
escrow. So you're saying there's no evidence that your bank knew that escrowees' funds were being used to pay individuals?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that indicates that fact. We would ask this court to affirm on the basis that LaGrange acted in good faith and provide a reasonable equivalent value under Section 9A of the Act.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Carroll. Mr. McEntee, who do you represent?
Charter Bank, Your Honor.
So you're making a similar argument, or
Yes, Your Honor. I'm presenting argument on the same issue, and am appearing before the court this morning only to answer questions that the court may have with respect to the charter transactions at issue.
Any question? Guess not.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McEntee. So, Mr. Schreier, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Your Honors have heard counsel for the appellees essentially employ the inquiry notice rule in this case.
I know. Let me give you this example. So suppose on day one you swallow a pill or you have a headache. You swallow a pill. On day two you discover your hair has turned green. But a year later you discover who the manufacturer of the pill is. So when does the statute of limitations start to run?
In that sort of a common variety tort case, probably when my hair turned green.
Right. And why is this any different?
Because this is a fraudulent transfer act case where the sole purpose is to go after transferees.
But the thinking is the same. You see, I think your most serious problem is your failure to integrate discovery with tolling. Because in the case I put, it's understood you discover you've been injured. When you discover you've been injured, that's when the statute of limitations begins to run. But if you can't find the defendant or some other essential fact you need to actually draft a complaint eludes you, despite your diligent inquiry, then you get an extension. Right? And so that's how you enter. On your view, the tolling doctrine is completely superfluous because your conception of discovery is you have to discover what you need in order to sue, namely the identity of the defendants.
Your Honor, in connection with motions to dismiss in this very matter, the other side said your injury, the loss from the escrow, the fact that monies had gone out and you had been grievously injured, is the injury to speak of. And that's what should start the statute running.
Right.
Judge Darrow wrote a rather good opinion on the motion to dismiss where he said, nonsense. The existence of the escrow loss, your hair turning green,
nonsense.
Is not.
I don't think it's nonsense. The point is not that the money, was burned or something. The money was transferred from the escrow accounts, and that transfer was a fraudulent transfer in your view. So the fraudulent transfer occurs when the money is transferred away from the escrow accounts, then it's shifted around and ends up in various places, and that's the problem of identifying who you want to sue.
The drafters of the Uniform Act chose not to use inquiry notice and knowledge of a generalized harm.
Is actually in the statutory text.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
Inquiry notice is in the statutory text. I don't understand that argument. I thought your argument had to do with the fact that it expressly chooses the recipient rather than the receipt rather than the disbursement.
The transfer to rather than transfer from. It is both, Your Honor, because the language of the Act, 10A, talks about knew or reasonably could have known of the transfer. That is not normal inquiry language.
The
inquiry,
reasonably could have known language is the inquiry notice standard.
Judge Hibbler began the period when there was...
That's very weak when you deny the obvious. There may be good points here, but...
Judge Hibbler conflated or equated the beginning of an obligation to investigate with knew or reasonably could have known. They are not the same thing.
The same. Let me ask you the question about this fraudulent transfer. I don't understand it. I understand. Maybe just with regard to Grange and Charter. But if the banks don't know that it's escrowee money being siphoned off to individuals, then they can't be fraudulent transferees. That would be, as I think Judge Wood said, that would be strict liability.
Well, Your Honor, the facts are a little more complicated than that. What happened in one of these transactions, for example, is there was a $900,000 CD taken out from New Intercounty, Old Intercounty. The next day, the individuals who own the company borrowed that exact sum from the bank and used the CD to collateralize their personal loan. Little suspicious.
No. I understand that you might be able to spin a web of suspicious circumstances. What baffled me was your suggestion that you didn't have to show anything suspicious, that as long as the escrowees did not receive consideration, it was a fraudulent transfer, which cannot be right, right?
There are two defenses to my claim.
That's ridiculous. You cite my Scholl's opinion quite inaccurately on that point.
I did.
Because that's a case where the wife who receives the money knows that she isn't giving consideration to the corporations. So, but these banks don't know, LaGrange and Charter, they don't know that... If they're correct that they had no knowledge that this was escrowy money, they'd have no reason to think that the CDs and the liquidation CDs wasn't for consideration.
The court is focusing on the pledging of the money and the taking out of the CD. The second part of the transaction was when the loan was defaulted upon. What the banks went against to repay the loan was the CD. They foreclosed on the CD and took the money back that way.
So what's wrong with that? I don't understand you.
Yeah, I would submit, Your Honor, that it is at least a question of fact. I believe, Your Honor, that in terms of good faith, which is one element.
Good faith, fine. But you wanted to use the other branch of fraudulent transfer, the no consideration. That's what I don't understand. But anyway...
If the court has no further questions.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
To all the lawyers. Next.